Immigration Limbo, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The DACA program protects hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants who were brought here as children. President Trump may be about to end it.
Most DACA beneficiaries would now be in limbo. They may or may not still be eligible to work, depending on what Trump does about work permits.
Plus, the nightclub scene in Damascus, Syria, where not even the horrors of war can stop the partying.
People will clean the place, sweep the blood, and continue partying.
And 20 years after Princess Diana's death, this innkeeper on Martha's Vineyard remembers how nice she was when he met her.
Just really natural and not at all pretentious.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Thanks for being with us. We start today with DACA. That's shorthand for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It's a program that started under the Obama administration in 2012. It currently protects hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children. Under DACA, they've been able to receive work permits and avoid deportation. But a group of Republican state officials want the program gone, and they're threatening to sue the Trump administration if it doesn't act to abolish the program by September 5th.
The biggest question that I'm getting from my clients: what happens if my DACA is revoked? What happens if Trump says tomorrow that I'm not protected?
That's immigration attorney Lily Axelrod. I asked her how the looming lawsuit might affect the DACA program.
Trump can continue to do what he has done since inauguration, which is continue to accept new applications, continue to renew DACA for folks who need to renew. And if he does that, then the Department of Justice would then be defending DACA against that lawsuit, which it certainly could do. Trump could also gradually phase out the program, and there are a couple of ways that he could do that. One way would be to say, we're not taking any more renewal applications and we're not taking any more initial applications, but folks who currently have DACA can continue to receive protection and be authorized to work until their current expiration dates.
So they would be grandfathered, but only to the extent of the current term of their temporary approval.
Exactly. Another option would be to let current DACA beneficiaries continue to renew indefinitely, but not add any new people to the program. The more drastic options that, of course, everyone is very anxious about are the idea that Trump could, at any given moment, say the deferred action, that's the protection against deportation that comes with DACA, is revoked for everyone immediately. If that happens, he could also revoke the employment authorizations, though he would have to do that one by one. Or he could let those continue to be valid until their expiration date. But say, you know, if we encounter somebody who had DACA, they're now eligible to be deported, and having had that status in the past is no longer a protection.
Donald Trump has said good things about DACA, bad things about DACA. He's kind of been all over the place about it. Do you have any gut sense of where we're going on this? Has there been any sign that you're seeing of what direction he's moving in?
You know, my thought had always been that Trump both recognizes that DACA beneficiaries are great economic contributors to our society and that they are among the most politically popular group of immigrants. I think something like 76% of Trump voters in a recent survey supported not just DACA, but a path to residency and citizenship for Dreamers. So I think he recognizes that these folks benefit our economy and that voters recognize that. And I think that until now, he has also recognized that this makes his power over DACA a convenient point of leverage in the immigration debate, because if there's going to be any kind of vote about funding for his so-called wall or any kind of big comprehensive immigration or other enforcement action, his power over DACA is an important point of leverage to bring Democrats and other supporters of DACA beneficiaries to the table.
Meaning that he would support DACA and then use it to get more, you know, support when he tries to push for funding for the wall.
Right. Well, that would be the subtle version. And the less subtle version would say, I'm going to end DACA on such and such a date unless I get a vote on this bill or unless I get funding for this project.
Lily, if the Trump administration takes the most extreme step and shuts down DACA immediately, would suddenly canceling lots of work permits have an impact on local economies?
Absolutely. I think there's a myth that these 800,000 DACA beneficiaries are taking jobs from Americans, but actually the reality is that they're creating jobs for Americans. And across the country, there are everything from major companies to mom and pop shops that employ DACA folks. And actually, a number of DACA beneficiaries have started their own businesses, which would be put somewhat into limbo if those folks don't know how long they're going to be able to remain in the United States. So ending DACA would hurt not only DACA beneficiaries themselves, but also their employers, their coworkers, and the family and community members that depend on their hard work.
Lily Axelrod is an immigration attorney based in Memphis. In the aftermath of Tropical Storm Harvey, we've been reporting on immigrants in Houston. Many are fearful about asking for help because of their status. Disabled immigrants, though, face more than just legal risks when the floodwaters rise. Pancho Arguelles directs Houston's Living Hope Wheelchair Association.
When water starts rising, you or I probably could run or swim to safety. But if you are in an electric wheelchair, you know that you're not going to have a possibility to make a quick exit. Then if you are an immigrant who has a limited English proficiency, a lot of this information is given to you in a language that you are trying to better understand.
Remind us, if you're undocumented and you have a spinal cord injury or are a paraplegic, do you qualify for any government assistance if you're undocumented?
Sadly, in Harris County, that has been limited since 12 years ago when they made a decision to stop providing catheters, diapers, wheelchairs, and that made the life of our members very hard. That's how the organization was born. It has been repeated a lot that immigrants come to this country and have access to all kind of social services and welfare programs, and that's just a blatant lie. Even for documented immigrants, access to many programs is limited. We have a very high rate of uninsured people, both immigrants but also citizens. We have members in wheelchairs that sometimes had to wait up to 15 hours before being seen in the emergency room. Hmm.
Can you tell us the story of Armando? He's a quadriplegic man who lives in a flooded mobile home with his children. I know he called 911 over the weekend. They couldn't help him. You tried. Tell us what happened.
He lives with a family that takes care of him. And the water started racing in the trailer park where they live. So we were trying to get emergency personnel to get to them, but as you can imagine, the system was overwhelmed, and they had to evacuate themselves. At some point, they decided that the best thing to do was to get out. So they got a children inflatable pool that they had at the house, and they put him in there. He had to abandon his electric wheelchair, and then they put the two small children on it, and then they, Mari, who's the woman who he lives with, they had to walk across that parking lot and then in a couple of blocks with water up to their chest in the middle of the night, and he cannot swim. So I'm really inspired and blown away by the courage and by Mari. When crises come, I don't think immigrant communities are like, oh, life shouldn't be like this. My comfort is being challenged. It's like people are used to confront very hard situations. So with Mari, she never lost her cool. Armando, he was extremely calm.
Pancho, you mentioned state politics. What's interesting is Texas Governor Greg Abbott, he himself was paralyzed below the waist at age 26, and he's used a wheelchair ever since. Has that made him more aware of the problems faced by immigrants in wheelchairs?
That's a mystery to me. He chose to reject $6 billion of federal money for Medicaid expansion that will have really helped people who have healthcare needs to enroll in Medicaid and Medicare. These are U.S. citizens and legal residents. And he rejected that money, that it was really several billion dollars. After he won a lawsuit for the accident that he had, later he pushed legislation that limits the capacity of people to do this kind of lawsuits. It's really baffling to me.
Pancho Arguelles directs the Living Hope Wheelchair Association in Houston, Texas. Thanks, Pancho.
Thank you.
We reached out to Governor Abbott's office to hear more about their commitment to the wheelchair bound. We haven't heard back yet. The fight over who's a real American and who's entitled to live here can be a little galling to Native Americans. But even Native Americans can have their own disputes over who belongs. One such dispute involves the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. The Cherokee once held people of African descent as slaves. They became free after the Civil War. Culturally, those freed slaves were more Cherokee than anything else. But in 2007, the Constitution of the Cherokee Nation was amended to exclude these freedmen, as they're known. Then yesterday, a U.S. court ruled that was illegal. Marilyn Vann was lead plaintiff in the case and is on the line now from Oklahoma City. Marilyn, congratulations on winning the case. You must be pleased.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a long, hard battle for us to get to this point.
Marilyn, am I right in thinking that you had a grandparent who was a freedman himself?
Well, actually, it was my father, who was about 60 years old when I was born. He was listed as a freedman on the Dawes Roll.
Now, the Dawes Roll is relevant to this, but give us just a thumbnail explanation of what was achieved in court.
Well, what was achieved in court was that the people of African descent, known as freedmen, the court reinforced our right to remain Cherokee tribal members and indicated that we could not simply be removed at the whim and the will of this chief or that chief or this council. So it's a great victory for people who believe in tribal rights, civil rights, and in human rights.
Who is affected by this ruling? I mean, after 150 years, so many families must be mixed with families of other backgrounds. What's the criteria?
Well, a freedman was a person whose ancestor was listed as, quote-unquote, as a freedman on the Dawes Rolls, which were made about 1900 in order to divide the tribal lands.
Why is it important for you to be part of the Cherokee Nation?
Because, okay, first of all, my ancestors, they were a part of the tribe. They came on the Trail of Tears. The freedmen people, our ancestors, helped save the tribe, helped build the tribe. Most of the freedmen do have documented Indian ancestry. And this is who we are. It's like as if, you know, various tribal leaders, they have tried to rewrite our history, rewrite the history of the tribe to be something other than it is. This is who we are.
Now, not to sound cynical, but is there any financial benefit or practical benefit to being a citizen of the Cherokee Nation at this point?
There are some benefits. Every member of the tribe has access to go to various tribal or Indian health service clinics, regardless of their income. There are various different programs dealing with rental assistance or the like for low-income people, but also for a lot of things you need to live in the 14-county service area for the tribe. So, yes, there might be some benefits just depending on your situation and your location.
You had to fight hard for this recognition or re-recognition. It took about 10 years. How do you feel about the community of freedmen being rejected by the officials of the Cherokee Nation for so long?
You know, it's very saddening to have people, you know, play the race card. It's the old Hitler playbook, you know, point at somebody that looks different or worships different and try to make them the enemy so that you can gain power or keep power. It is sad to think that your neighbors, your own relatives reject you, pretend that some people may really be ignorant, but pretend that they don't know who you are or what you or anything. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people in the tribe that know very little about the tribe. A lot of the people in the tribe, they look Caucasian, they live lives of white privilege, and know nothing about the tribe except that they have a card.
Now, what are you going to do to try to help heal the wounds among the members of the tribe?
Well, one thing is that myself and other people that are freedmen Cherokees, I think we are going to try to build up our own communities. Let's all come together and build this tribe and go forward.
Marilyn Vann was the lead plaintiff in a legal case that fought and just won full citizenship of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma for the freedmen, the descendants of Cherokee slaves. Marilyn, can you say goodbye to us in Cherokee?
The word is, it actually comes is, until we meet again, Donda Doggle Dahi.
Thanks so much, Marilyn.
Thank you. Wado.
Just ahead, remembering Princess Diana 20 years after her death. You're with the world.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. It's hard to believe it's been 20 years since the death of Princess Diana. 20 years ago today, in fact. She died as a result of injuries sustained in a car crash in a Paris tunnel. The driver was trying to get away from pursuing paparazzi. Diana was only 36 years old. My BBC colleague Peter Hunt looks back on that day, August 31st, 1997.
Diana, Princess of Wales, is in hospital in Paris tonight. Seriously injured after a road accident, her close companion Dodi Al-Fayed has been killed.
Initially, it was thought this was a princess in peril who could be rescued, a former queen-in-waiting who would survive a crash in a Paris tunnel.
I first heard about the accident at 25 past 11 UK time on Saturday night from a reporter at CNN in Atlanta. He phoned up to say, "Can you tell me about the crash?" I said, "What crash?"
Dickie Arbiter had worked for Diana.
I then went into the living room, switched on the TV and saw this thing unfolding. And I thought, my goodness, nobody can possibly survive that. And then there was nothing.
His instinct was right. A drunken driver with photographers in pursuit had crashed into the tunnel's 13th pillar, killing three of the four occupants.
And now at 20 past five, there is an official announcement. Here's Andrew Crawford.
Buckingham Palace has confirmed the death of Diana, Princess of Wales. In a statement, it said the Queen and Prince Philip were deeply shocked and distressed by this terrible news.
I was in the office by 10 to 4, phoning around various palaces that had flagpoles, getting the flag down to half mast. Unfortunately, Buckingham Palace didn't have a flag. That story went on and on and on for a few days.
In Paris, Britain's ambassador Michael Jay was preparing to confirm the news that reverberated then and still reverberates now. The French Interior Minister was by Lord Jay's side.
I said to him, "Can I just have 1 minute?" Because I realised at that stage that this was not an ordinary press conference. This was the kind of press conference that the world was going to listen to and want to know about. And I just paused for a moment to write down, I think on the back of a receipt, just what I was going to say.
"The death of the Princess of Wales fills us all with deep shock and with deep grief."
Throughout the night, Tony Blair spoke with his officials. In the first flush of his premiership, he was searching for the words that would best capture a nation's pain at the loss of a princess.
"She was the people's princess. And that's how she will stay, how she will remain in our hearts and in our memories forever."
On a different continent, the media was clamouring for a reaction from Earl Spencer. Outside his Cape Town home, Diana's brother obliged, in a way the reporters might not have anticipated, and in a way that provided a foretaste of the eulogy he would deliver 6 days later.
"This is not a time for recriminations, but for sadness. However, I would say that I always believed the press would kill her in the end. But not even I could imagine that they would take such a direct hand in her death as seems to be the case. It would appear that every proprietor and editor of every publication that has paid for intrusive and exploitative photographs of her, encouraging greedy and ruthless individuals to risk everything in pursuit of Diana's image, has blood on his hands today."
The passing of the prime ministerially labelled People's Princess was marked by the people, in their thousands. They came to palace gates to leave flowers and to weep, an uncharacteristic display at the time of British emotion. They were grieving at the death of a royal they didn't know, but who, through her vulnerability, they felt they had a connection with.
"She's someone that every young woman probably wanted to be. Beautiful, she was just a lovely person. We all hoped that we could be like her."
The princess's body was brought home with royal ceremonial. The BA-146 of the Royal Squadron landed at RAF Northolt into the setting sun.
On this day, at this time, 20 years ago, few would have been in a position to predict how the public reaction would grow and how the Windsors would be wrong-footed by the perception that they were geographically and emotionally detached from a country and its suffering. On this evening in 1997, the priority was bringing Diana home. In life, after divorce, she was stripped of her HRH title. In death, the coffin of Diana, Princess of Wales, was covered with the royal standard.
the BBC's royal correspondent, Peter Hunt. That HRH title he mentioned, it stands for Her Royal Highness. Throughout her life, Princess Diana went to great lengths to avoid the paparazzi, including on her 1994 visit to Martha's Vineyard off the coast of Massachusetts. Gary Conover owns the Charlotte Inn on the vineyard. He got the chance to spend a day with Diana. Here's Conover sharing his memories of that day with my WGBH colleague, Marilyn Scherer.
It first started on my yacht, a 1923 classic yacht. And we were asked to take her on a little cruise in Edgartown in the Outer Harbor. So we arranged to have a nice private place for her to board the yacht. And we were cruising around for maybe a little over an hour. Just had a very, very pleasant, nice time. The weather was great. It was just a nice experience chatting with her. I was up on the bridge most of the time where she was. And so we had a lot of conversation. Then, unfortunately, somebody did tip off a reporter at the Vineyard Gazette, got a long-range photo of she and I sitting on the bridge seat, which is the photo that ended up in magazines, mostly in Europe.
So tell me, what you said she was very nice, you had a nice conversation. What do you remember most?
Just really nice in every way, just very natural and not at all pretentious or not at all, nothing but wonderful ways. And then, as I mentioned, my youngest son, Tim, was basically in charge of her daytime activities like going to the beach and water skiing and jet skiing and things of that nature. Just the two of them, he took her to some really nice private beaches where she would not be seen. I guess the most significant thing is that after doing this most days, she had told him she had never had such a vacation where the paparazzi was not always there, and wanted to do a little kind of thank you party for him at the inn. You know, it was just, that was also very nice.
You had said your son was very good at keeping the paparazzi at bay. How so?
Well, he's pretty smart, and he had a couple cars that looked exactly alike, so a couple times they thought she was in one car, but she was really in another, and one time he let air out of the tires so they couldn't follow them, and
really,
things of that nature. But every day, so there's only one other time she had mentioned that she had had a vacation that was so free of photographers.
Does it make you feel good that you were able to give her that escape from the paparazzi for that little bit of time that you were with her and she was on your yacht?
Well, yes, but it was more my son, you know, that did that, because he's the one that spent much more time with her than I did.
So you got the distinct impression she really enjoyed herself.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Gary Kahn over there telling WGBH's Marilyn Scherer about the day he met Princess Diana. It was back in the summer of 1994 when Diana visited Martha's Vineyard here in Massachusetts.
I like words.
A podcast.
Fat, buttery words.
About language.
Sniggly, chuckling words.
The world in words.
Wormy, squirmy, mealy words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.
I'm Carol Hills. A young Pakistani woman has created a new board game, and it takes on a touchy subject, arranged marriages.
The gameplay involves a matchmaker running around and trying to chase down three teenage girls while they're trying to avoid her and a loveless marriage.
What the creator hopes the game will accomplish ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. When I'm not hosting the show, I focus on political satire, especially cartoons from across the globe. And that's why this next story is so interesting to me. It's about Najih Al-Ali. He was a Palestinian political satirist. His scorching equal opportunity cartoons about Israel, Palestine, and the Arab world in general earned him both fans and death threats. And on July 22, 1987, Najih Al-Ali was shot in the back of the neck as he walked to his office in London. He slipped into a coma and died about a month later. At the time, the London police believed the murder was politically motivated, but were never able to find his killer. Now, 30 years later, they've reopened the cold case. Jonathan Geyer is an expert on political cartoons in the Arab world. Jonathan, tell us a little bit about Najee al-Ali. I mean, how did his background as a Palestinian influence his perspective as a cartoonist?
Najee al-Ali, as a young boy, was a refugee who was forced to flee from Mandate Palestine to a refugee camp in Lebanon with the founding of the Israeli state in 1948. And this tragedy, this refugee crisis, deeply informed his work. In fact, his signature character is Handala, a young, shoeless, spiky-haired refugee boy that the artist himself said represented his lost childhood. And in most or if all of Najee al-Ali's cartoons, we see this young boy in the corner, always his back towards the reader, and the young boy, Handala, gazes out into the abyss, the tragedy, conflict. And 30 years later, this young refugee boy, this cartoon image, is incredibly iconic in the Middle East. I've often seen it in graffiti. I've seen it in newspapers of all political stripes. It's a huge rallying call, an iconic image of Palestinian national liberation.
I, of course, follow cartoons closely, and the first Palestinian cartoonist I met just shoved a keychain in my hand with the little figure of Handala. So it was one of the first things I learned was about Najee al-Ali. But I know he made a lot of people on many sides angry. What did his critics say?
Well, Najee al-Ali was truly fearless in his skewering of all authority. He really took aim at Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, who at the time was the only business in town, and all the different Palestinian political parties. Now, of course, al-Ali also heavily criticized the Israeli government and its actions against Palestinians and Arabs. He also took aim at Arab Gulf countries and wealthy oil states, and of course, the U.S. and European states. I mean, he basically made fun of everybody. And when Najee al-Ali was based in Kuwait in the 80s, he was told in 1985 to leave the country because he was facing death threats for his criticisms.
And that's how he ended up in London, where he was eventually murdered.
Indeed. He was based in London drawing for one of the big pan-Arab dailies.
Why is his murder case being reopened now? Is there new evidence or was there pressure to reopen it?
We'd have to check with the London Metropolitan Police, but in a very rare instance this week, they released a photo of the murder weapon, a police sketch of the prime suspect, and new details about a map and the location of the shooting. So it does seem that maybe things have changed 3 decades later, that allegiances and alliances might have shifted. It's so far after Yasser Arafat's death, and things have so changed in Palestinian politics that maybe someone would be willing to speak out. And the police is eager to see if they can capitalize that to solve one of the great murder mysteries of the late 20th century.
Jonathan, you were based in Cairo for a number of years. You travel around the Arab and Muslim world frequently. How influential is Najee al-Ali today, 30 years on?
Well, Najee al-Ali has truly influenced a new generation of bold political cartoonists from Algeria all the way to Qatar and Dubai. His work is so widely available 3 decades later. And I think it's, on the one hand, just the pure simplicity of his aesthetic style. It's very straightforward. It's the young boy, the powerless young refugee who witnesses strife and tragedy. It's also his political message, incredibly independent. And this fearless independence is so rare in the Arab world where many newspapers are affiliated with political parties or the state. So this independence is really something that many cartoonists strive for till this day. And finally, his tragic killing shows that he's a martyr, not only for the cause of Palestine or for the cause of Arab independence, but he's also a martyr for the cause of free speech, which, of course, has great resonance as cartoonists in the Middle East and across the world continue to face a barrage of threats because of their work.
Jonathan, do you have a favorite Najee al-Ali cartoon?
There's one that's incredibly tragic that I quite love. It's Handala lying face down, having been shot by an arrow. And it's kind of like a finale. You know, we witness this young boy. He never grows up. He's always the same phase of his life in his childhood. And this one is sort of the finale of an apple sitting on the ground and an arrow piercing into Handala, the young refugee.
Jonathan Geyer is an expert on political cartoons in the Arab and Muslim world. Jonathan, always great to speak with you.
Thank you, Carol.
And you can see examples of Najee al-Ali's work at PRI.org. Before the war, Damascus, Syria's capital, used to be a place with a famous nightlife, bars, cafes, nightclubs. You might have thought that 6 years of conflict would have ended that. In fact, Syria's nightlife is still thriving in some of the most surprising places. My BBC colleague Omar Abdelrazak has just returned from Damascus. How much of the nightlife in Damascus is still thriving?
It was a big surprise for me. I was going to Damascus to cover the front line. But when I went out, I found a completely different life. A very small area crowded with night bars and nightclubs on the Western style. Crowds of younger generation who are celebrating and dancing on music, smoking shisha, as if there is no war on the other side of the city, less than 1 kilometer from where they were celebrating. For me, this was amazing. A younger generation fed up with the war and with the news of politics, and they have very short time to celebrate.
So what do they look like? You walk in and there's like a DJ and a lot of dancing. What's it like?
Exactly. You walk in, you grab your drink from the bar. Very loud Western music style compared to the traditional Syrian restaurants. Very loud, very thriving, sending a message in that way of either performance or style.
So is it a response to war weariness, or is it just a generational thing, like it's a new generation and they want somewhere to go to have fun?
Both explanations can work in this. It is also a kind of a challenge to the atmosphere of the war. And when it comes to the war and the music, it is a kind of generational expression of their frustrations or challenge from the war.
Omar, I understand one of the distinctive things about these clubs is actually where they're located in Damascus. Tell us about that.
It is in Bab Sharqi, and Bab Sharqi is only 500 meters from the nearest front line of Jobar. Those areas are held by the armed opposition, and while you are there, while you are having your drinks, you will hear the sounds of government forces shelling those areas. It is within the very close range of mortar shells that can fall any time on the area. People became familiar when the windows are shaken by the shelling and the voice of even sometimes missiles called the elephants. The government forces firing from Qasyun Mountain toward those two areas, Terma, Anterma and Jobar.
How do the people in the clubs react to hearing the fighting going on so nearby?
Well, I think they reach that point of reconciliation with this. And one psychologist told me that we have to move on. And if a shell will fall down now in this bar, people will clean the place, sweep the blood, and continue partying.
So it's kind of a political message as well. People are going to go out and have fun despite what's going on around them.
Some close friends, I mean, one of them, a famous novelist, told me, yes, the regime itself is so keen to encourage people to practice this kind of going out and partying and nightclubbing to show that Syria is a secular place that can accept and tolerate Western values. And also that people can live next to each other. This quarter, I mean, you'll find many bars there surrounding a famous mosque. But the conservative are more conservative now, and the secular are more secular and insisting even to practice that and show it boldly.
My BBC colleague Omar Abdelrazak, he's just returned from Damascus, where he explored the city's nightlife. Thanks, Omar.
Thanks, Carol.
This next story is also about the war in Syria and its effects on the animals at a zoo near the city of Aleppo. The owners and keepers fled long ago. The 140 or so animals were left to fend for themselves. Most died, but a dozen survived and have now found refuge in Jordan. They were rescued by members of an international animal rescue group who saw pictures of the lions, tigers, and bears on social media. My BBC colleague Sahar Zand met one of the animals, a lioness, at her new home.
This is Dana, a Syrian refugee and a new mother. Escaping the Syrian war and only a few hours after arriving in Jordan, she has just given birth.
The cub is tiny. He's like a small cat. He's got a milky white fur It really is quite an extraordinary view. The lioness, with all of her scars, feeding her newborn. Let's go.
Under the hot Jordanian midday sun, I'm walking through a very unique type of refugee camp.
Donna was brought to Al Mawa Sanctuary along with the 12 other last survivors from a war-torn zoo in Aleppo, rescued by the international animal welfare charity Four Paws. Amir Khalil, an Egyptian vet, led the rescue mission.
Hundreds of animals in the last 6 years died from hunger, starvation, lack of medicine, lack of food, also fear and stress, war.
Trapped in small cages, the abandoned animals were kept alive by the locals, risking their lives to feed them.
It was very, very difficult for them. What is priority? To go to check my kids at first if they have dinner or should I stay beside the animal?
Two Asian black bears, two tigers, two hyenas, two dogs and five lions were rescued.
We're going to the other side of the sanctuary. It's so big, we can't really walk from one end to the other. We're getting a lift.
Stop.
Thank you, Shokran. All right. We're at the far end of the sanctuary now. Inside the cage on my right, there is a tiger. He's very skinny. Various red marks exposing his flesh really stand out between his brilliant orange stripy fur.
The tiger is called Sultan, and on his way here, he almost lost his life after a cardiac arrest. As Diana Bernes, the head of animal care at Al Mawa, points out, just like Sultan, the other animals have also endured a lot of injuries.
Some kidney deficiencies, the dental problems, a lack of nutrition. They will receive medical veterinary care. We will have a dentist come in.
Again. One, two, three.
On their way from Syria, during a brief stopover in Turkey, the animals received their initial medical treatment. But years of trauma has left them distressed.
We've been asked to walk away because one of the bears actually tried to climb out of his new cage. We all thought that he's actually going to come outside and attack us, so we all had to run away.
He was put back into his night room to help him adjust to his new home.
We sat with him for about half an hour. We talked gently to him.
This is Diana Bernes again, head of animal care here.
We wanted him to know that we're loving, caring beings, and this is our role to look after him.
Eric Margulies. I'm a great lover of animals.
The American businessman and journalist has financed this mission.
There are so many innocent people, children, women, stuck and abandoned in war zones. How come you decided to rescue these animals over these people?
Mother Teresa put it very well. She said, you know, I can't perform great miracles, but I can perform many small miracles. And that's what I've chosen to do, because not many people are concerned about animals. Nobody wanted to sponsor this daring rescue mission, Operation Noah's Ark, as they sometimes call it.
Amir Khalil, the man leading the rescue mission, has spent the past 23 years of his life rescuing animals from war zones.
We see animals can connect to people. I watched it in all the rescue missions before, in Gaza, in Mosul, in Libya, in Baghdad. I saw every soldier, whatever which his nation, whatever he believed, he just put his weapon down and he wanted to see the animal and he smiled and he wanted even to take a selfie with the animal. I don't want to upset
it, really. The Princess of Jordan has now arrived. She's the person who has given this sanctuary to these animals.
Merhaba.
Both sides are willing to help to get them out. So I think that's a very important thing, because sometimes people can forget their own differences or put them aside to work for a different goal. And if animals can be a vehicle for that, that's great.
This is a fetus. That's a ribcage.
An ultrasound scan performed in Turkey confirmed that Donna was pregnant with twins.
Amir, how is she doing? How is the baby?
They don't see now signs for the second baby to come.
Like the rest of the animals from the zoo, the second cub also did not make it. But Hajar lives on, symbolizing a new beginning.
The BBC's Sahar Zand reporting from Jordan. For many young women and their families across the globe, marriage isn't a game. In fact, it's taken so seriously that matches are arranged sometimes years in advance. And often, not much thought is given to how the young women feel about their partner. Well, now such marriages are a game, a board game called, fittingly, Arranged. Nashra Balagamwala created it. We reached her at her parents' home in Pakistan.
The gameplay involves a matchmaker running around and trying to chase down three teenage girls while they're trying to avoid her and a loveless marriage, because the minute she catches them, she's going to marry them off to a less than desirable guy. So they're avoiding her by coming up with creative ways, such as being seen in the mall with boys or going and getting a tan because darker skin is seen as undesirable in Pakistani culture, or they're photoshopping themselves with alcohol or things that, you know, would be normal in most societies, but are seen as disgraceful in Pakistani culture. And this matchmaker is coming closer to them by drawing from her own deck of cards, and that's moving her closer to the girls, such as, like, you see a girl with childbearing hips, move six spaces closer to her. So it's actually like a really funny game, but it's highlighting these issues in South Asian culture.
How did you get the idea for this game?
It was inspired mostly by my own journey and my own struggle to avoid getting an arranged marriage. And I was being pressurized by my parents as I just turned 21, so the pressure was increasing. And I was trying to come up with some way or the other to get out of it, but it wasn't working out. So instead of that, I was like, I'm going to focus all my energy into creating something that will start a discussion about this topic and get rid of the problem once and for all.
So it sounds like you were sort of a literal participant in the game you ended up creating. What steps did you take personally to avoid a matchmaker?
I have worn fake engagement rings. I have put on skin tanning lotions and just generally gone to the beach and made sure I'm getting darker, made sure I'm seen in public with my male friends, you know, talked about how I want to pursue a career and an education. I've gone to art school, which is the worst of it all. And actually most or all of the things that I have done are part of this game. They're all cards in this game.
Who is playing this game? I mean, is it going to kind of usual suspects, or are you kind of getting it out there in Pakistan?
I'm getting it everywhere. There are a lot of people in the West who are interested in it and have, you know, pre-ordered it. With my friends in the West who I've play-tested it with, they find it super funny. Sometimes they're even rolling on the floor laughing. But a little while later, they're like, oh, this is your life? That's terrifying. And then it serves as an educational experience for them. Whereas with people in Pakistan, a lot of girls want to play it. And in fact, they want to play it with their parents so that it can be a conversation starter with their parents. Like, do you see how ridiculous these customs are? We need to break free from them.
What about Pakistani men? Are they playing the game too?
Yes, they've played the game too. And they actually, when they play it, they start laughing. And then after a little while, they go like, wait, this is the shit you guys go through to marry one of us? We're so sorry.
Have your parents played your game yet?
Yes, they have. They find it really funny, actually. But at the same time, when they realized I was trying to make a political statement out of it, they were like, oh, wow, we don't know how to feel about this. So they're kind of confused as to what they should be and shouldn't be thinking, because they're proud of me for actually going out and saying what I feel. But at the same time, they're a little concerned as well.
Do they want you to be in an arranged marriage?
They did. Growing up, they always wanted me to be in an arranged marriage, and therefore I had to meet quite a few people and even talk to them. But recently, over the past couple of years, as they've seen, I've become so outspoken about it and so strong-minded. And I've essentially told the entire world, there's no way I'm getting an arranged marriage. So now I think they're coming around to the idea of me marrying for love.
What made you feel that way?
I've been that way since I was a child. I did not like how engineered these meetups were, how you only got to know someone for a couple of weeks before deciding whether or not you want to spend your life with them. It just made no sense to me. It was like, I end up, you know, leaving friends after knowing them for a while. I don't want to spend my life with someone, share everything with them if I don't know them well enough. And I'm just a hopeless romantic as well.
How prevalent is arranged marriage in Pakistan?
It's very, very common. In the more rural village areas, that is the only way. With more educated families, the times are changing. People are starting to change their minds because the younger generation is trying to fight for love marriages. However, even when it does end up happening after pleading with your parents for months or years, even then, society will always say, oh, the guy and girl were friends, because it's taboo enough to be friends with just a male. So marrying someone for love is even worse.
Do you think the questions you have about arranged marriage and your desire to break free of these traditions, is it a new thing that's coming from your generation, or are you simply expressing something that people have felt for a long time?
I think people have felt it for a long time. However, free will marriage wasn't legalized in Pakistan until 2003, and therefore in my parents' generation, there was no way anyone was going to speak up about it. In my generation, people do want to speak up about it, but still, they're very afraid.
You called them free will marriages. Do you mean simply somebody marrying who they want? That wasn't legal till 2003 in Pakistan?
Absolutely. It wasn't legal until 2003. Your father had to be the one making the decision. So until then, you legally could not marry someone without your father's approval.
In your game, it seems like you're both critical of arranged marriages, but you're also respectful. You're not entirely kind of dissing the whole thing.
I'm not dissing the whole thing, because I do have cousins and friends who have gotten arranged marriages, and they're very happy, because it is a way for girls in a society where you don't really have too many male friends and don't date to meet a man. So therefore, I can't be completely against it, but I personally do not want it for myself, and I don't like the other things that accompany it, such as, you know, the woman having to pretend to be this perfect woman at all times, and having to go out of her way to be that, even though it's not who she is.
My last question, Nashra, is now that you've made this game and you're sort of becoming a public figure and lots of people are getting in touch with you, like us, do you feel like that has given you more freedom?
Definitely. It's actually changed my life, because now, firstly, I'm considered to be unmarriable because I've spoken up and I'm so strong-minded. So it's relieved me off that whole pressure of arranged marriages, which is great. And then secondly, I have been less and less afraid to speak up about it. It's just been very liberating. And it's been amazing to have women from Pakistan and India reach out to me all the time to talk about their issues, and to be able to help them is just such a wonderful feeling.
Nashra Balamgamwala on her board game. It's called Arranged. It's about arranged marriage. She's been speaking to us from Pakistan. Thanks, Nashra.
Thank you.
That's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back tomorrow.
PRI. Public Radio International.